Hey, it's you, man, from KC95 here. Good evening and welcome to Toasted Tavern. Your host, Scott Tobin, and the man called Wags are ready to bring you the night in sports. So pull up a stool, grab a drink, and let's get toasted.
And welcome into the Toasted Tavern. I am Wags, joined alongside by Scott Tobin. Back with you on a Monday night as we wrap up the week that was in the world of sports. Some good, some bad, some weird. There's a lot of stuff going on tonight, surprisingly, for a Monday. Before we get to that, Scott, how have you been? How was your week?
It was good, man. It was good. It took me 3 or 4 days to get over that wild card game, but I've recovered finally, and I'm doing all right.
Sounds good. Sounds good. Yeah, I'm right there with you. I'll be perfectly honest, and I've dealt with an illness over the last week, so I've definitely not been myself. I did not watch a single second of the wild card game last Wednesday night. I fell asleep at 5 o'clock that night and did not wake up until 4 a.m. the next morning. I missed everything.
Yeah. You told me that the next day. You missed a hell of a baseball game, man, because for what you want in a playoff game, a do or die game, that game had it all. I mean, you know, it was intense from the get go. Every inning there were runners on base for both teams, it seemed like. And, you know, it was a good game. You know, the Cardinals proved that they could play with the Dodgers. Frustrating that they couldn't score. You know, the middle of your lineup struggled. Although, you know, like they say, it's a game of inches. And I know you missed all of it. But in the top of the ninth inning, you know, the Cardinals, Tommy Edman gets a double or gets a base hit, steals second. He's standing on second with one out. Tyler O'Neill hits the ball down the right field line. And Mookie Betts was playing in right center field, so he's nowhere close to this ball. It comes off his bat, and it looks like it's going to land and probably be a triple. The ball was about a foot and a half foul. If it lands fair, Edmund scores. It's a triple. The Cardinals are up 2-1. Arenado's up, and who knows what happens. Unfortunately, it was foul, and we know what happened after that. The Cardinals don't score. Giovanni Gallegos tears his nail off his thumb, can't pitch. Alex Reyes has to come in after T.J. McFarland gets the first two outs, has Cody Bellinger 0-2, and then walks him. Bellinger steals second, and then Alex makes a bad pitch. And, you know, you can't do that against a good team in a big inning and, you know, paid for it with the two-run homer to left field. But, you know, it was a good ball game. You know, it was an exciting ball game. There, like I said, there was a lot of action back and forth. It was intense. You know, both teams played well. Although, I will say, Mundo Sosa just about gave me a heart attack because he should have had about three errors in the first two innings of that game. They ruled two of them hit somehow. Not really sure how that happened because they both hit him right in the glove and he booted them. But, yeah, they ended up – you know, it was a really good game and an exciting game. Just didn't turn out quite the way we wanted it to.
It did not. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Cardinals and the offseason plans here in just a little bit. And for Matt – we're going to get to Saturday quickly, yes. We're ready for Blues hockey. We're talking about that in a little bit as well. But, man, before we came on the air, some breaking news dropped. And it was one of those things that felt like might have been percolating, might have been coming after the last couple of days. Some leaked emails came out over the last few days between John Gruden and some people in the NFL. When he wasn't working with the NFL, he was working at ESPN. Some racist remarks. Now today, some ones with homophobic and transphobic remarks came out. And about 15 minutes ago, it was reported that John Gruden tendered his resignation as the head coach of the Las Vegas Raiders. Once again, after the stuff that just came out, it's not a surprise that this happened. But that's really all I got to say. I mean, John Gruden was never a guy that, from what I saw, ever exuded any of that kind of stuff. Definitely an intense guy, definitely an interesting person, but nothing that I've ever thought he would, you know, basically put out there. And even some of his former players up until today came out and were saying, look, we don't believe that this guy is racist or has a racist bone in his body, blah, blah, blah. But then all this comes out today, and now it's very hard for anybody to really defend somebody like that with the stuff that came out. But he did tender his resignation from the Raiders, and he will no longer be the coach. I mean, what was your reaction when you found out the news, A, about the leaked emails, and B, now about him resigning?
I mean, once those emails came out, he had to resign. There was no choice. You know, he was either going to have to resign or they were going to fire him because the backlash was just going to build and build and build. You know, you hate to see something like that happen. You hate for there to be racist and homophobic emails. But let's be honest, those emails, most of them were 7, 8, 9 years ago. And the way that, and maybe he's not a racist. Maybe he's not a homophobe. But I can tell you that knowing how culture has changed and knowing how guys in locker rooms refer to people and things that have been sent, I'm sure that if you go back 7 or 8 years, 10 years ago, and see some of the comments, some of the things that people said, what they thought was in private to each other, were just as bad or worse and didn't mean what they mean now. And in some ways, you know what I mean? It was a different time. Not that I'm defending it. It's just the way things are just different now than they were then.
They are. And the culture of those locker rooms was wildly different. I mean, this is back before, actually right around the time that, you know, Michael Sam was drafted by the Rams. The inclusion was really starting to become a big piece of the sports landscape. Whether or not it needed to be a big deal at the time, it should have been something that never has to be a big deal, but it was. So that was really kind of the start of the NFL's, I guess, shift to, you know, promoting and helping bring awareness towards, you know, the that community as well. So you're in that position, that time frame of, you know, it was, I wouldn't say accepted, but in that culture, it felt like it was accepted by the people that were having those private conversations. But like you said, nowadays, things have changed. The perception in the landscape has shifted. Nothing is private anymore. Even stuff that back in the day you thought was private is not private anymore. And that's why, you know, you have to be incredibly smart and careful with what you say and how you say it. You know, I'm one of those people that I'm open to all possibilities. And I don't want to push anybody one way or the other. I'm not going to push my narrative on anybody else as well. And it's just a hard thing to do. And unfortunately for John Gruden, it has cost him his job. Now, the one thing I was reading was, you know, the Raiders may not have been able to fire him in a sense, because when the comments were published and made in those emails, he was not an employee of the NFL at the time. He was working for ESPN. So they weren't sure of the legality of being able to fire him if that were the case. And it seems like the NFL was really, you know, trying to put the pressure on really Gruden himself to, you know, resign himself so as not to have to go down a legal battlefield to try and, you know, make this happen. So you look at it and like you said, there probably isn't a racist bone in his body. There probably isn't a homophobic bone in his body. It was the culture that he was a part of at the time, but I believe he did do the right thing by resigning. Now the next step, at least for Gruden, I believe, is in a sense, and I don't know if you can make amends, but finding a way to try and make amends to help, you know, turn this in from a negative into somewhat of a positive in a sense, to help, you know, the gay and lesbian community, or, you know, the inclusive community, as far as racism is concerned. There's things that he probably needs and should do to not necessarily repair his image, but at least maybe try to make amends.
Well, here's the problem. You know, while everybody wants everything to change and everybody wants everybody to be a certain way, when you make a mistake and when these emails have come out now, there doesn't seem to be any forgiveness for those people. John Gruden's career in life is pretty much over as he knew it. He's never going to get a job in broadcasting or in the NFL again because people won't allow him to. Which you talk about him making amends, even if he tries, it's not going to matter because people now are going to label him that no matter what, which isn't necessarily right either. But, you know, that's just kind of where we are right now. And you talked about the NFL putting pressure on Gruden to resign. I guarantee you most of that is because the NFL knows that if you start digging in that hole, you're going to find a whole bunch, because John Gruden wasn't the only person to come out and criticize the NFL for putting pressure on the Rams to draft Michael Sam. I guarantee you there were probably, if you really dug, there's probably 32 teams that were doing the exact same thing.
Oh, no question. And I mean, we're seeing that right now with the situation with the lawsuit with the Rams in St. Louis. There's a lot of things that the NFL does not want to come to light. And this is another one of those, because I'm sure that there were multiple people, like you said, that may have even worse emails or conversations that would come out if they were to dig a little bit deeper in this. It's just one of those things that makes you go, oh, here we go again. And not to make light of the situation, not to kind of put this on the back burner, but it's like, it seems like every day or week we have something else popping out from 8, 9, 10 years ago that is now affecting people in their normal lives at this point. Once again, you have to look at the concept and the time frame that these things were said. Not making it a right thing or defending any of those sorts of things, but you know, where do we draw the line as far as digging back into the past to try and find something on somebody? That's the thing that is difficult to kind of get past is, you know, where's that line? I mean, where is it?
Right. You know, I'm just glad, you know, with social media and all these things and making dig up stuff from 8, 9, 10 years ago, you know, it makes me glad that there wasn't social media and all those things when I was 19, 20, 21 years old, because I know all the dumb shit that I said and things that I didn't really mean but came out of my mouth at different times in my life that could come back and bite me right now. So I'm really lucky, you know, just because – and everybody's like that. You know, kids make mistakes. People make mistakes and say things. It's just – it's a different world now, and you have to be responsible, and you have to really think about what you say, what you put out there, because once you put something out there, it doesn't disappear. It's there forever, and somebody, if somebody really wants to, they're going to find it.
That they will, and they'll twist it the way they want to twist it to make exactly. It sound in a bad light. So basically, the moral of this story is be smart with what you say, be smart with what you do, and you know, really just be careful with who you're around too, because you just never ever know. And for John Gruden, that means the loss of a job, the loss of the head coaching position with the Raiders. We'll see if anything else comes to light from this over the next coming days or so. That's going to be a very interesting story to follow as well. And we're going to get back to the NFL here in a little bit. The Ravens and Colts are wrapping up week 5 on Monday Night Football right now. The Colts are up 17-7 on the Baltimore Ravens. The potential Ravens fumble, but we'll see if anything happens from that. And Matt's right. If you can cancel Chappelle, you can cancel anyone. Although the Dave Chappelle thing actually, it might actually not be canceled in a sense, but that's a whole nother story for a whole other show. We're going to get back to talking sports because that's what we're all about here on the Toasted Tavern. We're going to get back to the Cardinals real quick because that is the big story in St. Louis right now, at least until Saturday when the Blues open the NHL season, although the NHL season starts tomorrow. I don't know why they're not playing until Saturday, but we'll get to that as well. But getting back to the Cardinals, yes, they lost the wild card game to the Dodgers in heartbreaking fashion, I would say. You know, a walk-off home run to the Dodgers, not a team you want to lose on a walk-off home run. Adam Wainwright pitched well. He did everything he was supposed to do in that game. You mentioned earlier, you know, the offense just could not do anything. 0 for 11 with runners in scoring position for the big three there in the middle. What ended up ultimately going wrong for this team in the wild card game, despite the fact that you had a dominant pitching performance from Adam Wainwright? You got to Max Scherzer early. Yes, it was for just the one run. But what ended up happening in this game that they were not able to do the last couple of weeks that they were doing the last couple of weeks of the season?
The Dodgers bullpen was just unbelievable. You know, they came in, it started with Joe Kelly because fifth inning, Cardinals knock Scherzer out, you know, Goldschmidt and Tommy Edman were on first and second, one out, and you just couldn't get those runs home. The Dodgers bullpen just shut the door after that fifth inning. And, you know, they brought in four or five guys and they were able to just shut the door and not allow the Cardinals to get any big hits. You know, you go back and look at that game. Edmund was on base twice. Goldschmidt was on base three times. Harrison Bader was on base three times. Nobody else was on base in that game. Those three guys were on base multiple times. Nobody else in the lineup did anything. You know, and you're not going to win like that, unfortunately. You know, they just couldn't, like I said, couldn't get that big hit. And that happens sometimes. You run into tough pitching. The Dodgers couldn't either. You know, the Dodgers had runners in scoring position three or four innings. And the Cardinals shut them down. You know, it just came down to Chris Taylor, who was like 3 for his last 45, so I guess you could say the do factor finally happened, and we know Chris Taylor's a good ball player, and Reyes threw a slider, and it hung, and he lost it for him. So, you know, it happens. The most frustrating thing for me watching the playoffs moving forward is that the Cardinals are out and the Brewers and the Braves are still playing, because the Cardinals are a better team than either one of those two teams. They've played three games in that series now. This was the third game today. Milwaukee scored two runs and they have 13 hits in three games. Ooh. The only two runs they scored, they hit a pinch hit home run in the seventh inning in game one. Nobody in their starting lineup has driven home a run in three games.
That's insane. And you know, going back to Chris Taylor, you know, it's what I've always said. It's usually the unsung hero, the guy that is, like you said, in a slump, or somebody coming off the bench, the guy that you wouldn't expect doing it that does it. And that's what ended up hurting the Cardinals, was a guy that was due for a big hit, came up and got it. So, you know, you give all the credit in the world to the Dodgers. Obviously, they've been there the last 3 years. They're the defending World Series champions. I mean, you can't really, you know, sit there and say you lost to a lesser team. I mean, they won 106 games this year. So it was a great game. The Cardinals, unfortunately, couldn't pull it out. And yeah, they probably should still be playing right now. You know, the Brewers and Braves are teams that the Cardinals are better than and probably would have beaten if they would have advanced or been matched up against one of those two teams. So it's definitely a tough pill to swallow. But like you said, the Cardinals team was a better team than these, and you're going to see a decent amount of these guys come back next year. You know, you've got guys like Arenado, Goldschmidt, Wainwright, Molina. These guys are all locked in for next year. But really, it does come down to, where does this team go next? You got a lot of money coming off the books. You know, Matt Carpenter, Andrew Miller, among those. You got some free agents in Happ and Lester and McFarland and LeBlanc that, you know, you may have to look at finding ways to re-sign. But where does this team go? We talked about the shortstop position. We've talked about starting pitching potentially as well. But what's the target for you in the offseason for the Cardinals to improve?
I mean, I think you've got to look at – I think the three places you have to look is, you have to at least look at the shortstop market, see if one of those guys is available in a price range that you're comfortable with. You got to figure out – well, baseball has to figure out if there's a designated hitter. If there's a DH, then you've got to go figure that out. And then you look at the pitching market, and what do you want to do there? I mean, I don't think they need to go get Max Scherzer. I mean, from what we hear, Scott Boras is going to ask for $40 or $50 million a year, which the Cardinals aren't doing. I can't imagine anybody doing that right now for Scherzer. But, you know, I think they need to – those are the three things. I think you're probably going to see – if I had to guess which one of those things they spend the most money on, I have a feeling it's going to be the DH spot, because I think the shortstop spot is going to be too pricey for their blood, honestly. Unless, you know, I mean, I was looking again today. There are a lot of them. I mean, you know, there's only so many teams that are going to be looking for shortstops. And you've got Seager, Correa, Story, Baez, Marcus Semien, who nobody's talking about, who hit 45 home runs this year. You know, all those guys are going to be available. And then you've got guys like Adelton Simmons, and a bunch of other second-tier shortstops. So I think they're going to look at that. I think the DH spot is probably where I would focus. A guy that could be your DH, could be your fourth outfielder, and potentially even play some first base. And I know a lot of people have talked about Castellanos. If he opts out, I actually am more interested in looking at Baltimore and seeing if you could swing a trade for Trey Mancini. That's the guy I think that would be a perfect guy in this lineup to kind of fill into that five or six spot, because he could do all of those things. He could be the outfielder, he could be the DH, or he could be your backup first baseman.
I think that would be a great move. I mean, Trey Mancini had to speak cancer and had a great year this year. And yeah, he definitely would be a great fit for the St. Louis Cardinals. I mean, a lot of fans are clamoring for an Albert Pujols reunion. I mean, obviously that's something that could be out there if the DH is agreed upon with the new CBA. And that's going to be the thing that I think holds things up a little bit, is this contract negotiations for the collective bargaining agreement. Because until that's settled, I mean, you can't necessarily go out there and start making moves, because you don't know if there's going to be a DH next year. You assume that there's going to be one, but you're not going to go out there and sign a DH level quality player unless you know 100% that that's going to be the case. And until that CBA gets negotiated and signed, it's going to be slow markets for baseball.
Yeah, and that's hard to imagine, because it's been slow markets the last couple of years anyway. I think the CBA is going to get done faster than people think. I mean, we really haven't heard a whole lot of bickering going back and forth. You know, we've seen some stuff about new rule changes, and it seems like everybody kind of is in agreement as to what they need to do. So hopefully this thing gets done quicker than everybody thinks, and, you know, it's kind of business as usual in the offseason, which would be really nice. I'm excited to get to the hot stove league because I do think the Cardinals are going to make some moves. You know, if I had to say exactly what my wish list would be for the Cardinals, it would be, I think it would be Trey Mancini. And then I think John Gray is probably one of those starting pitchers that you could look at, wouldn't have to give up a whole lot to get. And then we've talked about this a couple of times. I kind of think one of those shortstops you might be able to get on a one-year deal. A Javi Baez type guy might be there. And, you know, I think if you could make three moves like that, all of a sudden, the Cardinals are definitely World Series contenders with what you've got coming back already.
And, you know, we talked about Javi Baez, I think it was about 2 weeks ago. And at first, I was like, come on. No, I mean, seriously. That's just insane. But the more that I've thought about over the last couple of weeks, it does make a lot of sense. It's a familiarity thing. He knows the NL Central. He knows the teams that he'd be facing. It would be a sort of redemption, you know, gap year essentially, where he comes in and tries to have that bridge to a bigger contract. He has the connection with Yadier Molina. So there's all of that. And then, you know, couple the fact that it, you know, he would be coming back and playing for his bitter rival when he was with the Cubs. Who knows what that would, you know, entail. We've seen it go both ways, you know, Cubs coming to the Cardinals going to the Cubs, that they've had big years for the opposite team. So you've got that as well. It's become a lot more intriguing for me in the fact that Javi Baez could potentially be a Cardinal next year. And it's still a little hard to swallow. It's still a bitter pill potentially. But when you look at the numbers that are being thrown out for shortstops, and if it makes sense to bring him in on a one-year deal, I think it's the way you have to go. And I think I have come around to the fact that I'd like to see Javi Baez in a Cardinals uniform.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, it's just going to be really interesting because, like we said, you've got all of these shortstops and you only have so many teams that are going to need a big-name shortstop. You know, the Yankees are already attached to Adelton Simmons, which doesn't make a lot of Yankee fans happy because they want Trevor Story, but Simmons would be a good fit in New York with his defense. So if the Dodgers aren't in because you don't, you know, they've got Trey Turner waiting in the wings to take Seager's spot, and the Yankees aren't in, they're your two biggest markets. So that drops the price a little bit if those two teams aren't competing for a shortstop. San Diego is not going to be looking for a shortstop. You've got Tatis. So, you know, there's three teams. You know, the Giants aren't. You've got Crawford. So all of a sudden, you're starting to narrow the big spending teams potentially down, and you've got all of these shortstops. So maybe one of these guys, maybe a Carlos Correa, maybe, you know, even a Trevor Story, one of these guys maybe doesn't get the offer that they want, and they say, okay, the Cardinals are bringing back Wainwright, and they're bringing back Yadi, and they've got Arenado, and they've got Goldschmidt, and they've got this young outfield. Maybe I do sign a one-year deal in St. Louis. Maybe I go there for a year and see if we can win a World Series, and then, you know, I try to have a big year and try to cash in again. And then that wouldn't be the worst thing for the Cardinals either, because that gives you another year to see if Dalvin Perez can improve in the minor leagues, or to see what you've got, you know, when Paul DeJong plays a little bit, you know, if you don't trade him, or if Sosa can play a little bit. You know, it gives you time to figure out what you want to do, if you want to extend one of those guys to a long-term contract the following year, or if you say, okay, 1 year is good, and then we're going to move on again. So, you know, there's a lot of options there.
Well, you talk about the Giants and, you know, having Crawford there at shortstop. I mean, if the DH comes into play, why not move him there and go after one of those big-name shortstops? Because he only has a short time left. I mean, Crawford's getting up there in age. He has probably only got a few years, if not 1 year left after that. You know, why not go out there and you know, maybe let him play shortstop next year, but you go out and you sign a Corey Seager or a Trevor Story and you DH them next year and then install them as your shortstop. So, yeah, that's – you may sit there and think, okay, there is a big spending team off the books, but in all reality, they're not, because they would be signing this guy to play be the DH and then following Crawford's retirement, moving him into the shortstop position. So I know it's just one team, but I don't feel like you can essentially rule out the Giants. Now, like you said, the Yankees, yeah, you can rule out essentially because they already have the DH plan in place. But, you know, San Diego's another one too. they've got a lot of talent, but don't you think that they would prefer to have a guy like Tatis being the DH and staying healthy and maybe getting one of these guys to play shortstop and add to that power?
Yeah, and that's a possibility, although I think San Diego is going to go out and spend a bunch of money in the pitching market again because that's worked out so well for them the last couple of years. So I don't know if they want to move Tatis a whole lot. I think they kind of like the idea of him being the shortstop. So we'll see. I mean, they could still be in it. You know, who knows? We've seen weirder things happen. So, but it'll definitely give us something to talk about the next couple of months.
It certainly will. And, you know, kind of pivoting back to the Cardinals, I just want to ask you a quick question about Happ and Lester, because these guys were able to come in and kind of solidify this pitching rotation and really help propel this Cardinals team to their 17-game win streak and getting into the playoffs. Do you see them being able to bring back or wanting to bring back either one of those guys?
John Lester wouldn't surprise me. I don't know. Happ, you know, there may be some more teams out there that are interested in Happ because he pitched pretty well and he's just a little bit younger than Lester. I think Lester was really happy. I think he really liked what happened with him and Yachty. It wouldn't shock me if John Lester came back for, you know, $3 or $4 million or something, $5 or $6 million. That would be the guy. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
And then, you know, there's going to be some rotation holes opening up, and the guy that is being projected into that spot is Alex Reyes. You know, he definitely struggled in the second half of the season, blew a lot of saves, obviously gave up the home run to Taylor to end the Cardinals season. But do you see Alex Reyes going in as the guy that's essentially in that spot, and he's the one that is going to lose it if it's going to be anything?
No, I don't. I think they're going to give him an opportunity to see what he can do. But, you know, look what they're going to go into next year with. I think we saw enough from Dakota Hudson to feel like he's going to be healthy next year. You know, Jack Flaherty was able to pitch, which was huge. You know, I think you feel pretty good about those two. Waino's coming back. Michaelis looked pretty close to the Miles Michaelis of a couple of years ago. So there's four spots. So, you know, I think they're going to probably – I think they will go out and add another starting pitcher, you know, and still may bring John Lester back because I think they saw – you know, they thought they had all kinds of depth this year and it didn't work. You know, and so I think you're going to go get a guy maybe like a John Gray, somebody along those lines, one of those second-tier type guys that you can bring in here to have them compete. You may bring a Lester back, and then you're going to have Reyes, and you're going to have Libertor, and you're going to have Thompson, and you're going to have Oviedo, and you're going to have – Jake Woodford. I mean, Jake Woodford looked really good down the stretch. Did he go real deep? No, but when he pitched, he was giving you four or five competitive innings every time he went out there. So you're going to, unless you trade a couple of those guys to go get something else, I mean, you're going to have a lot of depth there. So no, I don't think anything is for sure with Alex Reyes. I think you just go into spring training and say, you know, everybody's going to compete and you're going to have to try to figure it out because they're going to have to rebuild this bullpen too because, you know, TJ McFarland and, you know, a couple of the other pieces that were really good down the stretch are free agents, and they're a little bit older, and there are going to be some teams that may throw some money at them that I'm not sure the Cardinals want to match. So, you know, you're going to have some questions with your bullpen again. I mean, you're going to have Gallegos and Cabrera. I think you feel like Cody Whitley's a piece in that bullpen. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, Jordan Hicks is going to go pitch in winter ball. You know, if Hicks comes back healthy, then you've got four guys. But after that, who's in your bullpen?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, it's going to have to be either a higher-priced veteran or you're going to have to install some of these younger guys into there, like, you know, like an Oviedo or somebody to that effect. Or maybe you do put Woodford back there as your long reliever or something. It's going to be a real interesting case study as to what the Cardinals are going to do. And, you know, I'm surprised that, you know, you think that Max Scherzer isn't coming to St. Louis because I feel like a couple weeks ago you were like, yeah, I'd love to see Max in a Cardinal uniform. And I don't think that's changed. I think you would love to see Max in a Cardinal uniform. But, you know, let's say, you know, obviously Scott Boras wants the moon for him. But let's say Max goes, look, I want to sign with St. Louis and I'm going to take whatever, you know, I'm going to make as much as I can, but I'm not going to bankrupt them to build a competitive team. Do the Cardinals even kick the tires on that? Do they make an offer and say, hey, look, I know you're looking for $40 or $50 million. If we say $30 million and you sign with us and take it, we're good. Do you see that being the possibility, or are the Cardinals just 100% completely out on Max Scherzer?
I'm sure the Cardinals will make a phone call to Scott Boras and say, okay, what exactly do you want? Because we're hearing this. Although, you know, I think it's probably pretty doubtful that the Dodgers let him out of the building, especially with Clayton Kershaw having questions about his elbow. They're saying he's not going to have Tommy John, but you're just not sure. So I would imagine that the Dodgers are probably going to give him whatever he wants if he wants to stay in L.A. But, yeah, I'm sure the Cardinals will kick the tires. But, again, you know, as much as I love Max Scherzer, he's going to be 38 years old, and I'm not giving a 38-year-old pitcher $40 million.
Oh, nah. No, not at all. And, you know, you they lose Trevor Bauer, obviously, so they are down a couple of star pitchers if Clayton Kershaw can't go next year. And if that's the case, if Kershaw does end up having to have Tommy John surgery, is that the end of his career? Is he if it's Tommy John or retire, do you see him retiring?
I don't think so. Because I think he's still got a little bit to prove to win the Cy Young. And Clayton Kershaw is not as old as you think he is. Clayton Kershaw is only like 34 because he was like 20 when he came up. So I think he's still got a couple of years left. I mean, if Justin Verlander at 38 went and had Tommy John because he was planning on coming back, you know, I think Clayton Kershaw would come back. A name that I will throw out there, veteran pitcher that's going to be a free agent that I would keep a real close eye on because – a couple of years ago, he was interested at the trade deadline. He was going to drop his no trade to come to St. Louis. Don't totally throw the name Zach Greinke out of the back of your mind as a possibility in the Cardinal rotation.
I know that he's been a guy that the Cardinals have definitely looked at in the past, obviously, especially when he was with Kansas City. You got a pretty decently close look at him in those I-70 series as well. That would be an interesting one to add in there as well. I mean, another veteran presence, a guy that can probably solidify and kind of settle down a rotation just like Wainwright did this year as well. Yeah, that'd be an interesting look if Greinke were to look at possibly coming to St. Louis as well and if the Cardinals are interested. So, like you said, a busy hot stove coming up here as soon as the playoffs end. We've got a lot more to go as far as the playoffs are concerned, so we'll monitor that as we go over the next couple of weeks as we get nearer and nearer the World Series. Maybe the Cardinals lost to the eventual World Series champions. We never know. So the Dodgers and Giants series is going to be has been good so far and will continue to be good. Let's jump over to the NFL real quick because, like I said earlier, you got the Ravens and Colts playing on Monday Night Football. The Colts hold a 22-13 lead over the Baltimore Ravens right now. A bit of a surprising score, I think, for both of us. We both picked the Ravens to win this game. And there were a lot of really, really good games this week. Thursday night game between the Rams and Seahawks went to the Rams, and the Seahawks lost Russell Wilson, and he's going to be out for an extended period of time with that finger injury. Geno Smith, who I didn't even realize was still in the league, is going to be taking over for the Seahawks. Actually engineered a pretty good drive up in Seattle, almost won them that game. But for me, it looks like this is the end of the road for Seattle. Looks like it's the Rams and Cardinals that are going to be fighting for the NFC West title. The Cardinals, a victory over the 49ers yesterday to move to 5-0. They're still the only undefeated team left in the NFL. Congratulations there. That was a low-scoring game, not one that we expected it to be, but a Cardinal victory nonetheless. In your mind, is it down to the Rams and Cardinals?
Probably. Arizona still scares me because we saw them play really good in the first half last year, and then they kind of fell apart in the second half. So I'm still a little apprehensive about Arizona. I think they're better. I think, you know, they've improved that team, but I'm still a little nervous when it comes to them. Going to be a really good game on Sunday. They play the Browns on Sunday, so that should be a really interesting game. I'm going to blame Russell Wilson being out on those god-awful uniforms the Seahawks were wearing on Thursday night. Whoever designed those has to be colorblind. Those things are brutal.
Well, they're color rush, so I don't know.
I would not be a football player and feel good about putting that on and going out into a football game.
It definitely paints you as a big-time target, for sure. I mean, you can't miss them. You can't miss the jerseys.
No, the lights could have gone out, and they still could have played that game from the glow coming from that green uniform.
Oh, the neon. Yeah, it's those color rush uniforms are interesting, to say the least. They've been around. Actually, they've been around since the Rams were still in St. Louis. That's how long they've been around. Very interesting colors, for sure. You had the Falcons taking out the Jets over in London this past week. I think a little bit closer of a game than we expected, 27-20. It was the victory for the Falcons. The Jets kept it close, but that was just a very pitiful game for London fans to watch the Falcons and the Jets play. Even though they scored 47 points, it probably was a bitterly boring game.
Yeah, it wasn't great. I saw a little bit of it. Although Atlanta's offense is starting to play really a little bit better. It seems like they're starting to figure it out a little bit. Real quickly, I'm going to disrupt our football talk real quick. We were talking playoffs. The Red Sox just walked off the Rays in the bottom of the ninth. Boston advances. The Tampa Bay Rays are knocked out of the postseason.
I mean, not much of a surprise because they're a team that always seems to do well in the regular season and just cannot, outside of the 1 year making the World Series, just can't get out of their own way. So that's not much of a shocking result, but a bit of a shocking result after the year that they had this year. But I'll be honest, no one talked about Tampa Bay this year, so I don't know if anybody really knew what kind of team they were. I mean, yes, they won the AL East, but
they had the best record in the American League.
Yeah, but sometimes that's not indicative of how good of a team you are. So, you know, we know how much the Red Sox and Yankees struggled this year. So it's not like it's the dominant AFC or AL East of the past. So it's definitely hard. Like I said, I did not hear much talk at all about Tampa Bay this year.
And just for a quick tie to the Cardinals, the losing pitcher for the Tampa Bay Rays brings back some old memories for the Cardinals. Michael Wacha on the mound to give up the game-winning hit to the Boston Red Sox.
So Wacha has given up a game-winning hit to the San Francisco Giants and a game-winning hit to the Boston Red Sox. Yikes. Well, glad he didn't do it this year. Back to football. Had a really interesting game in Cincinnati, Green Bay, and the Bengals matching up. Five missed game-winning field goal attempts in that game between the Packers and Bengals. The Packers ended up winning on Mason Crosby's fourth attempt at a game-winning field goal. That game yesterday was good up until the last couple of minutes. I mean, it was just a back-and-forth kind of game. And then it came down to the kickers, and you were just like, one of these guys has to win it. And, you know, once Mason Crosby missed, Then the rookie kicker for the Bengals popped it off the goalpost, and then Crosby missed one, and then the other guy, and then Crosby missed another one, and then the other guy kicked it, thought he made it, hit the flag, but it was no good. They were celebrating. They thought they had kicked the game-winning field goal, but really hit the flag on the outside, and then eventually Crosby hits that game winner. That was just an insane game on Sunday.
It was a total Bengals game, though. I mean, Cincinnati had a chance to win that game. And you have to look at that last drive that the Bengals had that set up the field goal that they missed at the end of regulation that would have won it. Instead of really trying to pick up yards, they just kind of settled for running the clock and trying to kick a 57-yard field goal to win the game. And that's a lot of pressure to put on a young kicker, and he hit the upright, and you don't win it. I mean, you would have thought they would have tried to get an, you know, 7, 8, 9 more yards there and really made an effort to get into better field goal range, you know, and the game was theirs. But again, you're not going to see too many games. Mason Crosby went into that game having made 27 field goals in a row, and then he misses 3 field goals and an extra point before he finally made one. So, yeah, just a weird game for sure. But Cincinnati's an up-and-coming team for sure.
They are. They look like they're a team that can compete and possibly win the AFC North this year. They're going up really against the Bengals team or a Browns team. That's pretty damn good. And we'll get to that game here in just a second. But some of the other games that went down on Sunday, Minnesota, a last second victory over Detroit in a game that Detroit thought they had won after going for two and successfully converting the attempt with about 37 seconds left. But Kirk Cousins bore down, got his team in a field goal position, and Greg Joseph hit a game-winning field goal for the Vikings, leaving Detroit as one of the only two teams to not win a game this year. Pittsburgh ended up beating Denver, a very solid game from the Steelers. Big Ben kind of bounced back from the criticism that he's faced so far this year. The Buccaneers over the Dolphins, no surprise there. New Orleans took out the Washington football team. The Saints kind of been up and down this year, so a bit of surprise victory there. Philadelphia came back from behind to beat Carolina, a very low-scoring, odd game down in Carolina. We both had the Panthers in that one. Both got that one wrong. Tennessee easily took out Jacksonville. New England was handling Houston for most of that game, but it ended up coming down to a field goal attempt for the Patriots to win it, and they did that game 25-22. The Bears beat Vegas in Vegas. Now, obviously, the stuff around Gruden was kind of swirling at that point, but it couldn't have had much of an effect on that team. The Bears defense just played a very, very good game, stifling Derek Carr and that Raiders offense that had looked so good this year.
Yeah, the Raiders didn't play that. I'm sure there was some stuff going around that Raider team all week after that. You know, some of that initial information came out. But yeah, they just didn't look like they just couldn't get their offense in a groove yesterday. And the Bears won. Justin Fields is 2-1, even though he still really hasn't played great as a starting quarterback. But he's got two wins under his belt. So congratulations.
Yeah, 111 yards passing. That's not the passing marks of a superstar quarterback right now. But once again, you get the wins. That's all that matters. Now we got to talk about that Cleveland game. They were in LA to play the Chargers. Looked like they may have had that game in hand for a while. They were winning for most of that game, but then the fourth quarter happened and both teams decided to go absolutely nuts offensively, trading scores back and forth. I believe the Chargers had four touchdowns in that fourth quarter. I believe they've combined for 41 points in that fourth quarter. Just an interesting game to say the least. You know, the refs definitely had a hand in it. You talked before we came on about how they, you know, the refs basically took a game away from the Chargers against Dallas earlier this year, and they kind of gave them this game against Cleveland with a couple of penalties late in that fourth quarter that extended drives. But Justin Herbert went absolutely wild, almost 400 yards passing, four touchdowns on the day. The Chargers look like they are a legitimate contender in the AFC West, especially with the Chiefs struggling like they are. What did you make of that game, and where do you see both these teams sitting in the hierarchy of AFC teams right now?
They're both really good. You know, we've seen it from the Chargers now all year. You know, they've been in every game that they have played. Justin Herbert's one of the next superstar quarterbacks in this league, no question about that. The Browns should have won that game. It was very similar to the game in Kansas City week one. You know, you had a two-touchdown lead going into the fourth quarter, and then your defense can't stop them. You know, you gave up four straight touchdowns on four possessions at the end of that game, and you just can't do that and win. The Browns are good. They had a bunch of injuries on defense. Denzel Ward was out. Jadeveon Clowney was out. You know, that hurt their defense. But, yeah, those two teams are going to be there. They're going to be playoff teams, and I think they're going to be two of the top seeds in the AFC when we get to playoff time. The AFC's crazy, though. I mean, you look around, and it's like, wow, some of the teams that I expected to be really good are not. Kansas City is just – I don't even know what to say about the Chiefs. They look like – and I was worried about this. They look like a team that believes in their own hype. You know, when training camp started, Travis Kelce and Tyreek Hill were talking about 17-0, you know, that they weren't going to lose a game and, you know, they were so much better than everybody else. And they don't look good. Patrick Mahomes doesn't look good. He's throwing balls. I mean, he's gotten – Patrick Mahomes is really, really good, and he's really, really talented, and he's gotten lucky with some of the crazy throws he's made the last couple of years. It's not working for him this year. He's throwing balls, falling down, and making, you know, just throws that he shouldn't be making, and they're getting picked off. He's thrown as many interceptions this year as he did all season last year already. They have no running game. They can't run the ball, and they can't stop anybody, and Mahomes is making mistakes. That's not a winning formula. I told somebody a couple of weeks ago, they reminded me very much of those 2000 Rams. The Rams the year after they won the Super Bowl, in between their two Super Bowl trips, the team that lost to New Orleans in the playoffs, they could score, but they couldn't play defense and they couldn't play special teams. And this Chiefs team reminds me a lot of that team.
They really do. And I'll be perfectly honest, I took a risk and I had picked Buffalo in that game. I thought Buffalo was playing a much better game going into last night's matchup, and I felt that they could go in there and beat the Chiefs, and they did. They beat them handily, 38-20. I mean, it wasn't even really a close game, and I think that's the thing that really surprised me and surprised a lot of people was that the Bills just went in there and dominated. I mean, you look at it, Josh Allen, 15 of 26 for 315 and three touchdowns, also ran for 59 yards and a touchdown as well. 315 yards on 15 completions. I mean, that's 12.1 yards per pass. The Bills averaged 8.1 yards a play. I mean, it took them 1.25 plays to get a first down on average. That's just, it just tells you right there how poor the Chiefs defense is. And I mean, it's not like last year's defensive output was great, but it was more bend don't break than anything else. And this year, it's just completely broken, and somebody's going to lose their job over it.
Yeah, Steve Spagnuolo's job is definitely in jeopardy. There's no question. And like you said, their defense hasn't been great the last couple of years, you know, but they were able to do enough offensively, didn't make mistakes, and they were able to come back from those deficits. You know, they're just not able to do that this year. And the fact, like we said, that they don't have a running game now, and Zolaire is going to be out for a while, it looks like. You know, I heard some rumblings today that they may bring Todd Gurley in for a workout to see if he can take over at running back for a while. But, yeah, there's a lot of problems in Kansas City. It's going to be tough for them to – I think they'll still be a playoff team more than likely, but I don't think they can be looked at as a favorite.
Oh, no, not at all. Not with the way some of these other teams are playing right now. And that kind of segues us into the winners and losers from this past week. For me, winners, you got to look at the Bears. I know it's kind of hard to say that when Fields only completed – 111 yards passing, but their defense did a number on a very good Raiders offense. They held Josh Jacobs to just 48 yards rushing. The offense still didn't do enough to win, but if their defense plays like that, it can, you know, they could be like the Tampa Bay Buccaneers back in the 2000s, where they won solidly because of their defense. The offense did just enough to win games. So I got them as my winners. I got the Chargers as one of my winners as well. I believe that was, despite the fact that the refs did help them, it was a bit of a statement win. You know, you go in and play a team like the Browns and you beat them. So I think it's definitely a win for that. And I got to go with the Bills too, because they did. They won in all facets of the game, defense, offense, special teams. They took it to the Chiefs in their home stadium and really solidified themselves, I think, as the number one team in the AFC right now.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Definitely Buffalo is a big winner in that one.
And then loser-wise, the Chiefs, first off, bad defense, just really, really bad defense. And like you said, Mahomes equaled his interception total already from last year, and it's just five games into the season. You got to look at the Giants. They lost Saquon Barkley, Daniel Jones, Kenny Galladay. They had their receiver Tony ejected in that game. And, you know, it was a team that, for me, had a lot of potential, and they're just spiraling and just wildly out of control. And it's kind of scary to see that, because they have talent. It's just it cannot be put together. And you said it, I think it was last week, you said, you know, Saquon Barkley's a bust. I mean, he's a guy that just has not been able to stay healthy and has not been able to produce, and the Giants are feeling that.
Yeah, that was a bad break yesterday. I don't know if you saw any of that, but, you know, he stepped on a guy's foot and his ankle twisted. I mean, I don't know if you saw the pictures of his ankle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I've torn ligaments in my ankle and had mine blow up like that within a few minutes, so I know what that's like. It's going to be they're going to be really lucky if Saquon Barkley is able to play again this year. And then same thing with Daniel Jones. I mean, he got hit and then had that concussion and had to be helped off the field. I mean, he took a couple steps and almost face planted into the field after that hit. I mean, he was out. I'll be shocked if Daniel Jones isn't out for a couple of weeks.
Oh yeah. I mean, concussion protocol and all of that, he's going to have to be out for a while. And it's just, once again, it gives you the feeling that the Giants might be a little bit cursed, and that sucks for them, but good for you Dallas fans, because the Cowboys won again and they're doing really well in the NFC East. I know you're waiting for the inevitable fall, but the Cowboys could be for real this year.
Oh, they're going to win that division because everybody else is bad. You know, and I mean, even that Giants team with, you know, missing four wide receivers and a running back, it's not like Dallas blew them out. You know, that game was closer than it should have been for three quarters.
It certainly was. And then finally, we talked about this earlier. Losers this week for me, kickers. Now 13 missed PATs, and then those five missed field goals in that Bengals-Packers game. You know, we give kickers crap all the time because we feel like it's a non-position. It's, you know, for former soccer players that couldn't cut it in the Premier League or anything like that. But it's still a part of the team. It's a difficult position, and the fact that you're starting to see a lot of cracks in the armor, essentially, it makes you go, man, sucks to be a kicker. And now we're going to start overly celebrating made PATs because of how many they're missing.
Yeah, you know, people wanted that moved back 5 yards because they thought it was too automatic. Well, they got what they wanted, you know. And kickers are a selfless job. You know, I mean, they get blamed when they they get blamed when they miss, and when they make it, that's what they're supposed to do. They don't really get any credit. So it's not the most fun job to be a kicker on a football team.
No, it is not. All right, let's get into it, because Saturday is the day. NHL starts tomorrow, but the Blues, for some reason, don't play until Saturday. I'm going to bring in Blues Fan Reacts here to talk about Blues hockey here.
Well, I guess I'm here now. I was just kind of vibing in the backstage. I guess I gave it the right time.
Yeah, you certainly did. And we're going to have a full breakdown of the Blues season on Wednesday night, beginning at 6:30 on Toasted Blues. We're going to have that leading into our Toasted Tavern episode as well. But we want to talk a little bit between the three of us about what the Blues are going to look like this year, because the opening night roster came out today, and there are a couple of surprises on there. I mean, you look at guys Clint Costin getting sent down, Logan Brown, Mackenzie McEachern, Scotty Perunovic, all guys that are going to be down playing in Springfield at the beginning of the season. But Jake Neighbors made this team. Yeah. What say you, Blues Fan Reacts?
I mean, it's kind of interesting that I can understand why they'd want to send Perunovic down, kind of. I could sort of understand that. But when it comes to, Jake Neighbors, has he really been that impressive in the preseason? I mean, when I think about it, Jake Neighbors has been all over the ice, and it's been good to see. You love to see that out of a 19-year-old, getting his NHL debut. It's really nice to see. But, I can understand why they sent down Perunovic, but it just feels weird, to not see him. Because, if any of the prospects deserve a spot on the final roster, it's Scotty Perunovic. But, I could kind of understand, like I said, he needs a little bit of time, in the AHL just to really kind of hone his skills. And, hey, if we're giving Jake Neighbors the 9-game treatment, then maybe Perunovic is up next right after those 9. So, I guess it's really smart asset management by Doug Armstrong there. I'm actually really impressed.
Well, you have to look at the depth on the blue line right now. You've got Krug and Parayko and Falk and Mikkola and guys like Jake Wallman that kind of deserve a chance up there as well. Scott Perunovic didn't get a chance to play last year. He had the knee injury, so getting him some game time, not sitting in the press box, is probably what they're looking at. I don't think the Jake Neighbors thing is the reason why Scott Perunovic is down, but I think it's more of why a guy like Dakota Joshua and Mackenzie McEachern are down. Is you want to give this guy the treatment that you gave Alex Pietrangelo back in the day. Give him a couple of games, let him see what he's got, and then go back down to his junior team after that, because you can't send him to the AHL. Mm-hmm. So very interested to see how that goes. And, I got to say it. I mean, Jake Neighbors came on our show last year and made the Blues roster. Colton Ellis came on our show, broke a bunch of QJMHL records. So we just got to once again continue to put it out there that
– Yo, Zach Bolduc, hit us up, man. Come on.
Exactly. Any Blues prospect that really wants to see their future ahead of time, jump on the show with us. And all of a sudden, it's going to happen, man. So get in contact. Come on.
Oh, totally. Totally, absolutely.
All right, so Blues open.
Okay, so can we all agree? Can all Blues fans agree now that was a good pick? Jake Neighbors is a good pick, because at the time that was the most controversial pick I think in my entire history as a Blues fan. Can we all agree that it's a fine pick now? Okay, good. Okay, just making it clear. Okay.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, I was not one of those that poo-pooed the pick. I mean, I
know
trusted...
a lot of people are.
Oh, a lot of people did. A lot of people did. Hated it.
I still have comments to this day on my entry draft video of people going, "What an awful pick!" And I'm like, "Dude, you got time to delete. It's fine."
You know who also was picked by the Blues that people were saying was probably could have been an awful pick. A guy named Vladimir Tarasenko. A lot of people were very down on the Tarasenko pick because
I don't really remember that one. That was right when I started watching Blues hockey, pretty much was right when that pick happened. So.
Oh, it's because he was playing over in Russia, and the propensity at the time was Russians did not come to the NHL, and they thought that the Blues wasted their pick on a guy that was never going to come. That's why he dropped as far as he did as well. So, I trust the Blues front office right now, and until they mess up, I'm going to trust whatever they do. And, hey, good luck on that, and we'll see how it goes. But
absolutely,
like I said, Saturday night the Blues are in Colorado for the first game of the season. Both you guys, kind of real quickly before we get out of here, just go ahead and give me your expectations of the season and where you think this Blues team ends up at the end of the year, pre-playoffs. We're not going to talk about Stanley Cup champions or anything like that, but expectations on this team, and where do you think they end up at the end of the regular season?
Scott, you want to try? You want to try this one? I need a second. I love blues. I got blues everywhere, and I don't even fucking know. So go for it.
Yeah, I still have a lot of questions about this team. You know, I think there's too many questions to really make a prediction. You know, like we saw today. You know, it came out the article again that Vladdy still wants to be traded. You know, so how does that play out? Where does he go if he doesn't get traded right away? Does it cause a distraction? You know, you talked about some of these young players. Are they able to come up and be key contributors right away? Did they struggle for a while? Do you have to send some of these guys down and bring up a Perinovich, some of those guys, see what they can do? You know, there's just a lot of questions with this team still. I think they're going to have a pretty good season, but we're going to get a pretty good test right out of the gate with Colorado. So I think we'll get an idea of kind of where they are to start the season on Saturday night.
Hopefully it's not another 8-0 loss.
Right.
No, that happened in game two, Wags.
Oh, that's right. You know.
I mean, I looked at a lot of players, especially Steve Dangle podcast. They did a review of, you know, what all of the, you know, they did a quick 10-minute review on the teams, and every single one of them had us at like sixth in the division. You know, they thought that we were going to do terrible. And I mean, I can understand why people would think that, all the pieces that we've lost. I think we're going to be a lot more competitive than that, to be honest. I think we're in the wild card race. I wouldn't go so far as say we're in the top three in the division by any stretch, but I say we're pretty heavily in the wild card race. And it's kind of funny because this is, you know, statistically probably one of the weakest Blues teams that we've seen in a while, you know, at least since 2017. But it's strange because I have a lot of this is probably the most confident I felt in the front office probably since I started watching Blues hockey. It's a really strange dynamic. I mean, I can't think of a single move this offseason that Doug Armstrong really whiffed on. I really can't. I mean, I like the Bull Duke pick. I like, you know, the Simone Robertson pick. I thought that was an absolute steal. We're just waiting for his ELC to finally come through. You know, I thought the Buchnevich signing, I think everyone can agree, was an absolute fleecing. Probably one of the big fleeces of the entire offseason. Brandon Saad acquired for, you know, a low AAV when he was rumored to get over 6.5, and we ended up getting him for 4.5. I think that's an excellent move. You know, giving Jake Neighbors and Scott Perunovich their opportunities, you know, in the preseason, and, you know, noticing how well they're playing, and then calling, you know, Jake Neighbors up. I think that's an excellent asset management, excellent moves. So all in all, yeah, I'm going to stick to my, like, you know, wild card race. We may make it, we may not. You know, I think we might have a rebuild on the horizon pretty soon here if we don't do very well this year. But I mean, it's going to be a frustrating season for sure, but I think it's going to be a pretty rewarding one, you know, seeing some of our prospects and younger, you know, assets come through.
I look at it as, you know, this is a team that is probably third in the division. I think getting back to the Central is going to be something that they're going to very much enjoy. I think they actually are going to take advantage of coming back to the Central as well. Yeah, we've struggled against teams like Nashville, but we've always played Colorado well. We've played Minnesota well. It's going to be nice to see Chicago, even though they're a little bit better this year than they have been in the last couple. Arizona is going to be there, another team that this team struggles with. But I think it's going to be a really fun season. I mean, I think Colorado is the clear-cut number one in this division. I think you look at Dallas, and Dallas is a sneaky pick to get there in that second spot. And I think it really does come down to the trio of Minnesota, Chicago, St. Louis. I think that's that 3-4-5 combination that you're going to have to really watch for the entire season. I think Arizona's going to be okay, but not great. I think Nashville's on the downswing, obviously. So it's those three teams that whichever one can really put together a good run, they're the one that's going to be pushing for that third spot. And then the other two are like you said, they're going to be there for the wild card. And one of them is going to get in for sure. I just don't know how that Pacific division is going to shake out. Depends on how good Seattle looks with the new acquisitions. Well, every new acquisition that they have this year.
Not very good. It's going to be a brutal first season for Seattle fans.
It probably will.
Calling it right here.
So, yeah, I mean, I think for me, I think I look at the Blues as being a team that I'm going to put them at third. I really do think they have the potential. They've got talent. They've got some cohesiveness. It's going to take a little bit of time to integrate the new players in. We've seen it every year. A new player comes in, it takes a little while to get there. But I like what James Neal did in the preseason. I think he can bring a Pat Maroon-esque type of game to this team, and actually sure. a little bit better than Pat Maroon. I like what Brandon Saad can do on that line. I think pairing him with Tarasenko is going to be really good, and I like what Buchnevich can bring as well. So it does. It comes down to just the cohesiveness of this team and the team chemistry. If they can knock that out early, this team can be very, very scary. And it really comes down to what Jordan Binnington and Billy Huso do in the Nets. And I'll be perfectly honest, I was impressed with what Billy Huso did in the second half last year. And I have confidence in him being the backup goalie this year.
I do as well. Yeah, I do as well. That's one of the big question marks about the season, you know, in general, is our goaltending situation. But it's funny when we think about our defense, you know, we see our defense and we're like, oh my gosh, there's so much depth. But that's probably our main concern is, you know, we got a lot of depth on D, but it's not a lot of good depth. It's just, you know, guys who can crack the NHL for sure, but it's like the bottom four are all, you know, bottom pairing defensemen if you really think about it. So like I said, it really depends on the cohesiveness of obviously Krug having a bounce back year, maybe getting some chemistry with Falk there. If Scandella's gonna have a good season, that's a huge question mark. He's slotted in a top four role. You really can't put him anywhere else, so if you do, you're just wasting his cap hit at that point. So
all right, Scott, last word on the Blues.
Again, man, just a lot of questions. I'm excited to see what they do, but I'm right there with you guys. I think they're probably in that wild card hunt. I'd probably say they're, if I had to guess, I'd say they're probably four or five in the division, kind of in that range. But it's going to be fun to see, you know, and who knows, maybe some of these guys step up a lot quicker than we think, and maybe it's a more exciting season than we're even expecting.
That is the absolute hope right there. Once again, a full breakdown of the Blues upcoming season, Wednesday night at 6:30 over on Toasted Blues leading into Toasted Tavern. I want to thank Mason, Blues Fan Reacts, for joining us here unexpectedly for the last segment. We kind of pulled him in when he popped into the background, and we'll have more of him on Wednesday night as well. For Scott, I am Wags. We want to thank you guys for joining us tonight. Enjoy the rest of the game that's going on right now. The Ravens are making it close. Yeah, it's gotten fun. And we'll be back with you guys Wednesday night for more Toasted Tavern here on the Toasted STL Network.
Hey, it's you, man, here from Casey. For all your sports news, catch the Toasted Tavern with Scott Tobin and the man called Wags weeknights at 9 p.m. You can follow Toasted Tavern on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Let's get toasted.